to hers mostly, and she's not always completely generous with his comments to me as a student. I don't think you guys will have any problem. Please welcome Michael Barr. Thank you very much. This was the first time since I started teaching Bruce that he's shown any recollection of the fact that he is studying with me. So I'm heartened to see that. We're going to be doing about an hour, a little over an hour of Adventures in Yiddish. I hope everybody got a copy of the handout that's being distributed at the front door over there. It will make things a lot easier to follow. The basic ground rules here are very simple. I get paid, and you guys sit there. But also, audience participation is not only welcomed, it's encouraged. If you have a question, or if I say something that triggers some vague memory of something, please stick up your hand and let the rest of us know about it. Much of the material in these lectures has in fact been gathered that way from some of the people have said, so I'm always happy to hear it. And I also haven't prepared enough material, so any help you can give me will be heartily welcome. Okay, any questions before we begin? There's an audience of actual truth. Okay, a great deal of what you hear about Yiddish, particularly in popular treatments of the language, tends to be nothing but what you call bogomizers. And this is precisely what I'm not here to talk about tonight and what I'm not here to give you. In a very technical sense, if I were going to tell you bogomizers, I would have to start talking about King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, etc., etc. The phrase bogomizer, which for those of you who don't know Yiddish, is generally rendered as something along the lines of old wives' tale, BS, something like this. As in, don't give me any of your bogomizers when you are defaulting on a loan or some such thing. And people, the Yiddish word boba means grandmother, mice is plural of mice, which means story. So, fine, you've got old wives' tales, grandmother's tales, whatever. Unfortunately, the phrase actually originates, it was a bobo mice. A bobo, this is why it became a bobo mice, it was like, what the hell is a bobo? A bobo is a bevis of Hampton, or a bobo d'Ancona, that is one of the knights of Arthur's Round Table. What happened was, in the 16th century, a guy named Elia Booker, who is known in English as Elijah Levita, who was a Jewish scholar, originally from Germany, but he was living in Italy, where I swear to God, he was a Milano to a number of cardinals. He was employed teaching Hebrew to the higher ups in the Catholic Church at the time. He's like, what a Jew doesn't do to earn a living. Elie Booker was a famous grammarian, etc., etc., but having nothing much to do with his country well before the invention of television, he decided to translate an Italian Arthurian romance about Bobo d'Ancona, Bevis of Hampton, into Yiddish. And he did so, and he called it the Book of Bobo. And this, although it sounds obscure, this became relatively popular. The last paperback, popular version of the thing, was published in Warsaw in 1910. So on a certain level, it enjoyed a fair shelf life. But eventually, you know, people started to wonder what a Volvo was. Well, you can see the origins of the thing. If you have a look at the Volvo book, it's like Lancelot and Galahad were on their way home from a bris one day. You know, they had to stop for Shabbos, and up comes a draft. It's basically these Arthurian stories, except all of a sudden everybody is Jewish. So you've got like the Knights of the Round Table with Tzitzis and Guinevere and her Scheifel, the whole deal. You know, it's Lancelot was doubling Schminestra, and you know, he put the tefillin on his chainmail. You can see fairly easily how this comes to mean BS. It doesn't take a great leap of the imagination to work this one out. The problem was, after the book stopped being as popular as it had been, and remember we're dealing with a time, you know, well before modern methods of mass distribution, people started to wonder what the hell it is a ball. It's like, stop telling me your bulbomizers. Well, I would be glad to stop telling you my bulbomizers if you would tell me what it is a ball. And of course, people couldn't do it. So what went on is what's called technically a process of assimilation. You take a word that you don't know, and you find a word that you do know that sounds a little bit like it, and you stick them together. So from Bogor to Bulbet, and you can see how long this takes. The time Elie Wiesel was writing, the Slavic element of Yiddish from which Bulbet comes had not really entered the language yet. But you find this word that sounds kind of like what's there, you stick it in, and in this instance, it happens to make some sort of logical sense. You can get some logical sense up out of it. A similar thing happened in English with the word bridegroom, as you just show an example. The original word was bridegroom, which, you know, face it, here is the bride, where is the groom? It sounds dumb. Groom is an old English word that means man, male. So bridegroom meant, you know, the male who is involved in this nuptial ceremony, and that was fine, until everybody forgot what a groom was. So they assimilate it to the word groom. Now, I've never seen anybody like, you know, out with a little thing currying the bride's name before a wedding or something, but this seems to bother absolutely no one. And it's the same thing with Budemeyer. You simply find the word, it's good enough, and you go on from there. Likewise, what I'm not going to talk about tonight, what I'm not going to give you these very Bubemeisters, or what you call in Yiddish, Nishkishtoigen and Nishkifloigen. They didn't climb up, and they didn't fly. We'll explain this in a minute. Zoma mamushes vider goyish of God. They have a reality or a substantiality like the God of the Gentiles. Yiddish is possibly the single most politically incorrect language ever devised. My own theory is it was devised precisely to be the single most politically incorrect language ever devised. You know, it's the counter language to all these Christian European languages. My father, who has a beard and wears a long coat, if he hits his hammer with a thumb and he decides to swear in English, he's going to say Jesus Christ. Because that's how you talk English. And he is not going to go, ouch, Rabbi Akiva. It doesn't work. It's the same kind of thing. You know, a language deals with a particular semantic field. The semantic field Yiddish deals with is Judaism. Judaism, for the last 2,000 years or thereabouts, particularly in Europe, is based on the idea of not being a Christian. And this is reflected frequently in Yiddish. So you can say something like, Amamushis with a goyish of God. Roughly, you know, it's as close to the real truth as the notion that the blood of Jesus will set us free. Now, if you look at the words there, there's a word there, Mamushis. How many of you know the word mamish? Either in Yiddish or in Hebrew? Yeah, mamish is, in Yiddish, it's used to mean literally in a figurative sense. So you say, the table was mamish groaning with food. Of course, the table was not mamish groaning with food, but you say this anyway. You know, the Hebrew word from which it comes, mamash, is in frequent use in modern Hebrew. Lubavitcher Siddim thinks it means, with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the word mamash has the same initials as Menachem Mendel Schneerson, which has the same initials as Melech HaMashiach. This too is Yiddish. But, you know, what the idea, it has a reality, a substantiality, like that of the God of the Gentiles. This is not an entirely arbitrary phrase. Most of the non-Jews among whom Yiddish speakers were living were Catholics of either the Roman or the Orthodox Rite. What is, anybody know what the cornerstone of Catholic Christianity, insofar as church service goes, is? No, nobody knows. Good. You're going to learn something. And when the priest holds up the host, the little piece of bread and the wine, And he says, "Hoc est enim corpus meum. This is really my body and blood." A process called transubstantiation is believed to take place, in which the wine and the bread actually turn into the body and the blood of Jesus. They don't simply represent it anymore, they turn into it. What you have in a phrase like Hoc nam amicus fidei voi sur God is a denial of the doctrine of transubstantiation. I am not saying that anybody who ever opened their mouth in Yiddish was aware of this, any more than that all of you knew that a bridegroom was really a bridegroom before 5 minutes ago. But this is, in fact, what's going on. This is the process that's taking place. You can see this idea of mamish, of reality. They talk in the Medrash, in some of the commentaries, talk about Chayshik Mitzrayim, the darkness of Egypt, the ninth of the tenth plagues, sheyesh boi mamish. It wasn't a simple absence of light, it was a positive quality. Anybody who ever had to suffer through first year English and read Paradise Lost will recall Milton's phrase, darkness visible, which is taken directly from the Medrash. So you can see the Yiddish is basically the underlying stratum to most English literature as well, even though some of the authors may not have been aware of that. Likewise, when we talk about something as nishgesteugen and nishgefleugen, and it didn't climb up and it didn't slide, the folk etymology for this expression is, what didn't climb up? Jesus on the cross. Where didn't he fly? Up into heaven. It's taken as a denial of the crucifixion and ascension of Jesus. Whether, in this instance, whether that really is what it is or not, is impossible to tell. But if you ask people from the old country, where does this phrase come from, this is what they'll tell you. It's occasionally contradicted. I used to know a man here in Toronto, an emeritus professor of medicine at the University of Tivas from Bukovina. He'd gone up in a small stable. He said, every year before Pesach, which often fell out around Easter, you know, when they take the dishes out to boil in a big cauldron and cash them for Pesach, they would cover up the pots that happened to be Easter because they were afraid that the Yoizola, Jesus that is, was flying around in the sky in a katan in the Yiddish pen. He was making poo-poo in the Jewish pot. So I don't know to what degree this folk denial of the ascension of Jesus Christ ever actually caught on, at least among people who have to clean for Pesach. Or, you know, if it can go wrong, it will. Again, about a lot of the kind of crap you hear about Yiddish, you can say, a nechtikiv tur. Literally a yesterday's day. If you look in the Uriel Weinreich's Yiddish English Dictionary, it is actually a very good English colloquial equivalent for this. Tell it to the Marines. You know, of course, in Yiddish, if you see a Marine, you go the other way in Yiddish. You don't tell them anything. My own grandfather managed to desert from two armies during the course of his life. I've maintained this tradition of valor. I just think of Jobs as the army and look like it's perfect. Again, a nectical tour, a yesterday's day means tell it to the Marines, stick it where the sun don't shine. But you look where the phrase comes from. This is the sort of thing that actually puts the yid into Yiddish. Those of you who go to shul, who go to the synagogue on Shabbos, will recognize the phrase from the 90th Psalm, Ki ela shenim lefanecha ki yom esmol. 1,000 days are before you. You in this context is God. Before you, to you, they're just like yesterday. Well, the standard translation, the standard Yiddish translation of this, which is called Tach, the standard Tach gives, for those of you who understand Yiddish, Toys and Tures and by dear God, as a black, the anesthetic tool. There we have it, the anesthetic tool. So again, how does this come to mean? You know, this is the question that perplexes the minds of the commentators. But if you look at the next verse in the Psalm, it talks about the evildoers, you know, that is people you know, who do not see the truth of God, etc., that they are like grass that withers, the idea being they wither under the harsh sunlight of the truth. You see here what's going on. Where something sacred, in this case this line from the Psalm, it's not profane by being taken down a step into day-to-day life to mean bullshit. Rather, the idea of bullshit is being infused, as it were, everybody's following me, with a sort of sanctity. You know, it's coming down and entering day-to-day life. You know, somewhere very deep in the structure of the language, and I would venture to say beyond the conscious knowledge or recall of the average speaker, there's this image of God sort of smiling ruefully down over the vanity of all human endeavor. You can see the same thing happening in another well-known Yiddish phrase. What do you call the bay crest in Yiddish? What do you call an old folk song? A moishiv de kenyan. Now, I will skip over the cheap jokes about all the people who have asked me who is the moishiv and moishiv de kenyan. Simply say it's moishiv de kenyan, a settlement of old guys. You know, it's a place where Alfar live. This likewise comes from a verse in the Psalms, which then this illustrates what has happened to Yiddish to a degree over here. If you daven Nusach Sfard, if you follow the Sephardic rite, which is not the Sephardic rite for Sfardim, it's the Sephardic rite for Ashkenazim, which spread all over Eastern Europe in the wake of the Hasidic revolution. If you daven Nusach Sfard before Mincha, before the afternoon service on Friday afternoon, you say the 107th Psalm, etc. Well, there's a line in there, Yiranamuhu b'kalam, they will praise him, they will exalt him in the congregation of the people, uvamoshiv zekeinim, there you have it, yahalaluhu, and they will praise him in the settlement of the elders. So elders here generally take to mean elders not so much in the sense of people advanced in age as people advanced in community leadership. Rashi says it's rabbis. Unkelus, the standard Aramaic translation of the Bible, which is printed in every Chumash, in every Bible, says it refers to the Sanhedrin. Again, you have these stiff-necked Jewish people, however, they're going to take it from the Psalm, but they're going to ignore what it obviously means in the Psalm. They're going to ignore what all the commentators say, and they're going to take the word Zekanim in its most basic literal sense, old guys. So the Moshe Zekanim becomes the settlement of old guys. You know, this is not what it's supposed to mean. But again, you see what's going on where the holy, the psalm here, is being used to do something to day-to-day life. Again, the sort of empty breath that you often hear about Yiddish is called hakken a chayne, or knocking a tea kettle. This is a famous, famous Yiddish phrase, usually like so much of Yiddish, expressed in the negative, hakken a mishka chayne, don't knock me a tea kettle. What this means, and you know, this is one that's like, how the hell does this have anything to do with anything? It's something like, he called me up and he started to hack me a chayne about his money problems. This means somebody who, you know, has an edate, a certain monomania that they always go on and on and on about whether you want to hear it or not. It's also one of those bits of Yiddish that penetrated at least into the Three Stooges. There are at least two Stooges episodes in which the phrase is used, one of which Mo is going off to a hawk shop, and Larry says, well, while you're there, hawk me a chayne. And the other one where Larry is disguised, it's always Larry, I guess he spoke the best Yiddish. Larry is disguised as a Chinese laundryman while running away from the police, and when apprehended, he burst into rapid fire Yiddish, which concludes with hawk me mishka chayne, and I don't mean Esher. Again, this is a sort of footnote. Everybody thinks that parents didn't like the Stooges because they were violent, although I never saw anything in the Stooges that didn't go on in my own house, as far as corporal punishment went. Yiddish-speaking parents had a particular aversion to them because they were always throwing in Yiddish, and usually of the least refined sort. The ones where Mo disguises himself as Hitler. He comes in speaking Yiddish, dressed up like Hitler. You know, the first word is paskudnya, and it goes downhill from there. You know, you still couldn't get away with this in English. But anyway, to hack a chat and to bother somebody to talk endlessly without actually saying very much. Now, where does the image come from? You have to think about China. China has a teapot. The old-fashioned kind that are sort of top-loaded. You put a pot of water on the stove to boil, and you leave it until it is boiled dry. What's going to happen? It boils dry, and the lid, the Sterkel, starts to flap up and down in the very image of a pair of moving jaws. It's, of course, making a lot of noise. It's really not saying a whole hell of a lot. And this is actually what the phrase means in its most literal sense. Again, this is a very, very common Yiddish phrase, so common, in fact, that those of you who are into the New Testament, this is great. Well, I went to the Yiddish lecture and you talked about Jesus all night. The authorized Yiddish translation of the New Testament, and there is indeed such a thing, people from Toronto will remember up until about, what, 4 or 5 years ago on Lower Bathurst Street, there was still the mission to convert the Jews. The authorized Yiddish version of the New Testament translates St. Paul's famous thing from 1 Corinthians, the 13th chapter. He says, "Though I speak with the tongue of men and angels and have not charity, I am become a sounding brass or as a tinkling cymbal." The Yiddish has quachiveh up the lashonis to mention in Malachim, I've spelt it to do here, hakech noa chayne. You have to give the translator some credit for knowledge of idiom, if nothing else. I mean, myself, if I opened up the Bible and found it said hakech noa chayne, I would wonder what kind of Bible this is. But, I mean, this is actually a very good illustration of how the idiom works and what it is. There are a number of other mistranslations from the Yiddish in the New Testament. Probably the best known is in the Gospel of Luke, where the shepherd comes down. The angel comes down, rather. It's a bunch of shepherds out there. The angel says, Shalom Aleichem. And it gets translated as, peace on earth. Which, if you take it back to the Aramaic that it must have been, there's a clear mistranslation going on there from the Aramaic in the instance. Okay, now, the words, the actual speech of somebody who has to do a chayne, you can have them in your linker peya, in your left sidebar, or in their linker piata, in the sole of your left boot. In other words, you're not really you're paying almost no attention. So you can see from the examples that I've just given, that is from Mishkishtoigen, Mishkifloigen, Anastikirtsun, Hakana China, Kinligen in der Rinker Peyo, or der Rinker Piate, that Yiddish phrases and expressions tend to have their origins in one of three major sources. The first is straight pungent metaphor, like in Hakana China, which is based on observation of the outside objective world, but it's given a little bit of a twist that may not be expected. So you can say, there's no reason not to say, people are always saying in Yiddish that somebody is suffering. But why leave it at that when you can say that somebody lives in Rehrenbach bagel? They're lying in the ground baking bagels. And this is, in Yiddish, at any rate, this is both kvetch and mission statement, all in one fell swoop. If you think about how the phrase operates and what's really going on, you get some insight into the world view that is operating behind this stuff. Liegen im Grab can mean, to lie on the ground, but obviously it can mean to be dead. It can also mean not to be doing very well. So you see somebody say, hello, Moish, how's business? And he says back to you, the business isn't there. This is, sit shiver for the business. It's the business of blessed memory. It's forget about the business. You can even tell somebody to go in there. This is the Yiddish equivalent of go to hell. But in this phrase, very clearly, they're talking about being in a specific place. And like I said, who is in the ground? Dead people. Now, Again, this is Yiddish. This is where it gets cute. Being dead is not bad enough. You've got to spend all of eternity baking day in hellishly hot conditions. They don't get the air conditioning part. Baking bagels, but being dead, they have no need to eat. Being dead, they have nobody to whom they can sell. Being dead, they don't even know anybody but other dead people who are all busy baking their own bagels that they don't need to eat and that they can't sell to anybody either. This is fundamentally the Jewish myth of Sisyphus. Except... Sisyphus, he pushes the rock rolls back. Sisyphus pushes the rock rolls back. Sisyphus at least comes out of it with muscles. You know, from the point of view of much Yiddish, you know, even when you hit that big sleeve, you know, all this is for a Jew is another opportunity to mention God, to suffer. It doesn't end. The form, this is very similar to the form of a lot of famous Yiddish curses. And you have to realize the basic idea of the Yiddish curse, which is famous as being a great kind of curse, if you want to tell somebody where to go or what to do off, you know, you're going to tell them that. Somebody who's going to hang around for a 10-minute elaborate curse, this is a social form, this is a game that's taking place. But you get these curses like Doktorin soll dich darben. Doctors should need you. Is it to assure themselves a livelihood? Is it for your value as, you know, research material? Notice that this is not specified. You know, you can find all these words, doctor, need, etc., in any language. But the way they're put together, there's something particularly Yiddish about it. Again, so let's look at another curse where the process is even clearer. There's a well-known Yiddish curse. I'm not sure people here who know Yiddish know this. Alle Zehn sollen dir ausfallen. All your teeth should fall out. The eine soll dir bleiben auf Sunday. Except you should have one left to get a tooth. Now, look what's going on here. Note what is not mentioned and what is not specified. It doesn't say anywhere that you should get the toothache now. The tooth that is remaining to you, this is insurance for the person offering you the curse. You're going to have the tooth, and he's not going to give you the toothache right away. He's going to give you the toothache when he's good and ready, and you should have the toothache. And in the interim, you can sit and you can worry and you can stew about it until hopefully your blood pressure gets so high that he won't need to give you the toothache. You see what's going on here? There's a dialectic, is a big word, operating, in which the effect of a Yiddish curse depends entirely on the intelligence of the person who is being cursed. You don't waste this on a moron. A moron, you can tell to go and drag, and that's it. So it's already a sort of a backhanded compliment when somebody says something like this to you. Again, the worst thing that can happen to you in Yiddish is somebody should wish that all your dreams come true. Because whatever is going to come after that is going to be a reasoned and probably fairly lengthy deconstruction of absolutely all. You know, the thing is, you should have $1 million, and you should own 1 million houses, etc., 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 etc. And it usually ends up with, and you should get into one of your million cars and go every day to a different doctor, and he shouldn't know what's wrong with you either. Good wishes in Yiddish is kind of like the smile on the face of a scorpion. You've really got to watch out for it. And again, it's this kind of dialectic. You know, people complain still, why did they not choose Yiddish as the national language of the state of Israel, given the fact that at the time it was still primarily an Ashkenazic settlement. You know, the Sephardic Jews had not yet become the majority. And people get angry at, you know, early Zionists and their antipathy to Yiddish as a bullis or an exile language. And there's all these claims, well, they didn't really get it. I spent years wondering how people who really didn't speak anything else very well, you know, you listen to the Hebrew of even people like Ben Gurion and Golda Meir, I mean, it's pretty good Hebrew, but I mean, they got accents worse than mine. You know, what these people were comfortable in was Yiddish. How can you go around saying they didn't understand it? Well, they got it perfectly. But if you can imagine this state, you know, it would have its, you know, it had a coat of arms, you know, heartburn on a field of cholent or something. You know, with a little motto underneath, Zolzlukim and Saman Mazel. You know, you should have my love. They got it perfect. You know, Yiddish is the only language I know of in which there is no generally accepted way to receive a compliment besides going, thank you. You know, somebody says something to you in English like, oh, you know, you're a great bassoon player. You say, oh, you flatter me. But translate this into Yiddish, those of you who know Yiddish, you know, dichanst es mir. This is like, you're licking my behind. You know, all right, what do you want? How much do you want to borrow? The only thing you can say is, you're machst mir a compliment. You're making me a compliment, which the person in question is already aware of what they're doing. Yiddish being Yiddish, you feel no need to point this out to them, because then they will think that you think that they're stupid, and you will get involved in another one of these cursed marathon enrollments. So basically, nobody ever says anything nice in Yiddish so that they don't embarrass the person that they want to say something nice to, because there is no generally accepted way of responding to a compliment. Okay, any questions thus far? Yes, I actually see a hand. Yes. Somebody is asking about a Yiddish curse. Zos wachsen die Abzügele, you should grow like an onion, mit dem Kopf in der Hand, with your head in the ground. In some version of that, with your feet up above. This is not one of the most sophisticated Yiddish curses. But if you look at it, there's a perfect illustration of what I've just been saying. There's a variant version of this also. Zos wachsen die Abnege, you should grow like a carrot. The same thing with your head in the ground. In traditional Jewish lore, onions and carrots are both considered, are not only highly auspicious, but they're considered emblems of prosperity, fertility, all this kind of thing. Those of you who continue to maintain the traditional practices or who come from homes in which they were maintained will recall that on the first night of Rosh Hashanah, you eat carrots. And you always say, you know, there's a brook that you say that our merits should increase. Well, no Sephardi ever ate carrots so that their merits should increase. Because it's a pun. In Yiddish, carrots are ner. To increase is nervenzer. Right? So it sounds the same. So it's a pun. It's a little pun. Again, you have a thing in Germany they used to eat on Hoshana Rabbah. Which is on Holomoid Silkus. And when you have the big Hashanahs, which we'll eventually get to, you take the willow twig and you smash it on the floor for a while, and you yell out this line, Kol Mavasser, Mavasser Leoner. A heralding voice is proclaimed. Well, in Germany, they used to, on Hoshana Rabbah, they used to eat cabbage soup. And this became like a sacrosanct custom among German Jews. The reason for this is unfortunately so prosaic. In German, if you kol mit Wasser, sounds very much like kol mit Wasser, or cabbage with water. And this is where the custom actually comes from. And if you talk to real Yekis, to real German Jews, this is like, you know, how can you have a Hoshana Rabbah without cabbage soup? You know, in the same way, if you talk to people following, you know, the traditions from Eastern Europe, you've got to have the carrots on Rosh Hashanah, along with the lamb's head and the fish's tail and all this other stuff that you have on the table. But like I was saying, the carrot and the onion, these are considered signs of prosperity, of increase. The very first time somebody ever said this, which I don't know when it was, but somebody says to you, Zosvaksen di ameya, Zosvaksen di atsindala, you're expecting like, you know, Zosvaksen di ameya, you should have millions of descendants who will conquer the world. But what are you getting instead is Zosvaksen di ameya, you should grow like a carrot with your head in the ground. It's this reversal of expectation. This is what I meant when I said, you know, the worst thing that can happen to you in Yiddish is somebody should come up and wish you the fulfillment of all your desires. They set you up and then they knock you right back down. Okay, any other questions? Well, that says a lot, doesn't it? I know what it means, but you'll hear this in more religious circles. But you know that's only one segment of the Jewish speaking population. You know, there isn't a recognized kind of formula of "Oh, thank you, you're very kind." Something like that. I beg your pardon? It's not a joke, it's not on front, it's called jokes. This is a lecture, the jokes are on Saturday night. This is the academic part, this is all on the final. This is true. It's expressed in a lighthearted manner, but it is nevertheless a Yiddish fact. You know, there just isn't anything. It's not so much a sense of time, a lot of time having passed, but the sense of having substantiality or reality. It's as real as yesterday. You know, as the student of math say, you know, yesterday is gone. You know, it just ain't there no more, and it's not coming back. That's, you know, that's how real, that's how much substance, whatever it is you have said, is thought to have. So yeah, there is that kind of time element in it. Okay, the next stratum, the next level of stuff from which Yiddish takes expressions and phrases is the basic literal meaning of words. So a nebish is somebody about whom you say nebach. Nebach is this very odd Yiddish word. It comes originally from Czech and is one of the first Slavic words to penetrate into Yiddish. Well before there was a mass immigration into Eastern Europe, people were nebuching all over Germany. It's almost impossible to explain. Nebuch is like an expression of pity and sorrow in like, you know, you can say, if somebody wants to say, you know, how's your father? And your father is not well, firstly, you never say he's sick. You say he's not healthy. You say, er nebuch nicht gesund. He's the poor fella isn't feeling too good. I mean, he'd be on life support. You know, you'll never find out from anybody in Yiddish until you ask them. You know, the worst thing, again, somebody, if you ask somebody in Yiddish, how are you, and they say, Fagnish, don't ask. This means they are about to answer at incredible, incredible length. Again, this is a language in not only does no mean no, but yes means no too. It has auto reverse. But again, you say, you know, the poor guy has nebach nicht gesehen. And without the nebach in Yiddish, there's something very, very wrong with this sentence. To say he has nicht gesehen, it implies that you don't actually know him. You know, it is, after all, your father of whom you're speaking. It implies an estrangement of really, you know, gigantic proportions. You can likewise say, you know, he nebach can't hold a job. You know, it's somebody that you feel sorry for whatever reason, hence a nebish. Likewise, you call somebody a klotz. A klotz literally is a wooden meat. You know, a clumsy oaf is a klotz. You call them a glomp, one of my dad's phase for me.
A glump is the stem or stalk of a lettuce or cabbage. Somebody who is a glump is a barely animate idiot. You're sort of just this side of a lineman of goyim, a clay golem, the Yiddish equivalent of the cigar store Indian or something. And again, you can find sort of equivalents of these kinds of things in any language, but only in Yiddish can you get the klotz kashen. That is, the question asked by a klotz. You know, if a wooden beam could ask questions, this is what you would get. And again, you see the way it fits together illustrates, again, what's going on with Yiddish. Again, a klotz kashe is an extremely stupid question. It's the kind of question, if I were doing exactly what I'm doing now, and somebody here puts up their hand and says, yes, but in view of the events of the Holocaust, should we go on speaking a language that has German words in it? And so, please, go ahead. It's that kind of question. It's like a real dumb question. But again, the standard Yiddish word for question, the basic, most common word, is not kashe. In fact, it's frage. A frage is, you know, a perfectly good word for question. Why is this not a klotz frage? Okay, there's the obvious fact of the alliteration here. Klotz kashe has a little more oomph, as Anne Sheridan fans would say, than klotz frage. It sounds better. But also, very technically, a kashe is a particular type of question. In the Talmud, if somebody asks a kashe, this is a question, almost a rhetorical question, in which the statement of an Amora, one of the rabbis in the Gemara, is being attacked. It's like the sort of, well, do you mean to say then that essence precedes existence, or whatever? You know, it's that kind of question. It's the idea of a fairly difficult question. The word itself, kasha, means difficult, or is rooted in the word meaning difficult, difficulty. It's a question that can't be answered with a simple yes or no. Again, how many, I'm sure everybody, or virtually everybody knows, what do you do, you know, you sit down the first Seder, the first Passover Seder, and you make Kiddush, and you say Alachma, you fill the second cup, the father ritually beats the eldest son for no apparent reason. And then what it says, so good, I count my father so good, it says, hit him now. Then what happens? Right, the youngest of the company, as it says in my Manischewitz English language Haggadah, the youngest of the company asks the fear kashas, the four questions, and what do you spend the rest of the night doing? Answering them. You can't just say, shut up, kid, and keep eating. You have to answer them, and it takes all that time. That's the kind of question that a kashe is. So the idea of a klotz kashe is, this is not just a stupid question, but this is a stupid question with pretensions. This is a stupid question that has come in a tuxedo. This is a question that believes everything its mother ever told it about itself, that it is beautiful and brilliant, etc. And again, you know, the main pretension is always to intelligence. To intelligence, rather. Okay, the third area, and by far the most important, Klotz Kashe leads us right into it, is, of course, expressions that derive from the sphere of traditional Jewish life and practice. And this is something that cannot be overemphasized. At one time, you know, when they started establishing the secularist Yiddish movement, well, this was established by people who had grown up in this atmosphere and knew exactly what it was they were rejecting. A couple of generations later, however, you have people who were inheriting things that they just didn't understand and repeating them by rote. You know, the understanding of this is essential to an understanding of Yiddish. You might not want to do it, but you will never have a handle on this language unless you know a fair bit about traditional practices, learning, etc. Even Max Weinreich, the great historian of Yiddish, who was not a religious man in the conventional sense of the word, you know, titles one huge section of his history of Yiddish, the language of Derech HaShas, the language of the way of the Talmud. It just shot all through everything. Even when it's hidden, as in something like Net Figure 2 that we saw earlier, it's definitely there, and it's definitely all over. So there are three basic ways of saying, to give an example of how all of this comes together, there are three ways in which you can say that somebody is looking totally run out. They're really looking tired. You can say that they are eisgemütschit and eisgemacht, which is what I am right now, me along with everybody else who speaks Yiddish. And if you look at the ads in the Jewish Forward, they don't have ads for Nike. They don't have ads for Gatorade with the Hexer. They have ads for hernia trusses. They still have a column, Fragen Social Security. Questions about Social Security. So somebody's eisgemütschit, eisgemacht, I mean, yeah, they're exhausted, they're run out, there's nothing left. Somebody was kommt davon schleppen mit den Füßen. They can scarcely trudge along on their feet. This is the literal level of it. You can draw a simile from nature. Somebody can look, as I always it's one of my favorites. You look like a rooster after performing its roosterly duties. Anybody who's ever spent any time on a farm will realize that when a rooster comes out to tread the hens, this is like, you know, there's a lot of hens and there's one rooster. And I never asked, but they apparently all have to do it at the same time. So a rooster will service, as it were, you know, 25, 30, a bison, you know, however many hens in a single night. The rooster is less than perky the next morning, for obvious reasons. You can look like a hood nut kashmish. But you also, you notice the word here, the word kashmish, which is what's being used for what the rooster is doing, totally does not fit. Kashmish is the rabbinic word. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, if you look in a code of Jewish law or something about laws to do with sexual behavior, they call it kashmish ami, meaning literally utilization of the bed. I've never worked this, I mean, this is obviously a big euphemism, but if this is the only way in which you can use the bed, I don't know when you're supposed to sleep. This is the only thought. And it gets shortened down to tashmish, you know, using or utilization. But to use this phrase and talking about a rooster is, the English equivalent would say, you know, he looks like a rooster who has fulfilled his communal obligation. You don't talk about this, you know, about one in terms of the other. It just doesn't quite work. Again, you can express the same thing from the specifically Jewish realm. You can say that somebody looks like an upgeschlagen Hashan, a whacked out Hashan, a whacked out willow tree. I talked a few minutes ago about what German Jews used to do on Hoshana Rabbah. But what everybody does on Hoshana Rabbah, you know, on Sukkot, on the Feast of Tabernacles, you have the so-called four species, the Arba Minim, which is a Lulav, and an Esrog, and a Hadassah, and a Aruba. You take the willow thing on Hoshana Rabbah, as I said before, and there are various customs determining how many times you're going to hit it. But you really hit it, and you hit it hard. And these are like tiny little twigs. They're not very thick. You can imagine what they look like after they've been beaten a minimum of five times on the floor or on the chair in front of you. They're not looking very good. You can say about somebody that they look at, again, they're looking not too sprightly. They're looking all run out. You can compare the opposite of this, which comes from the same stratum. Somebody looks the an almen noch schloischen, like a widower after the 30 days of mourning. This means dressed up to get messed up. Basically, this is the Yiddish way of, you know, all dudeed up and ready to party. According to Jewish law, very technically, if you are widowed, you are supposed to do your best to remarry within the next year. The thing is, the first month after the demise of your spouse, the shloishim, as it's called, the 30 days, this is when you're not, you know, you're in mourning, you say kaddish, you're not allowed to date yet. The idea of an almanac, a widower after the Schleich, you know, not only does it have a rather, you know, I think a sort of nasty, glancing look at traditional practice, but it's like somebody who is out there looking for something else as quickly as they can possibly find it. Again, not all this kind of stuff is necessarily conscious. As I was saying before, every Yiddish speaker who opens his or her mouth is not necessarily aware of the background of every Yiddish expression, whether it's coming from something in traditional Jewish life or whether it's coming from nature. Again, the number of people who actually know what Hakana China literally means, well, probably got about 80% of them in the world in this room now. It's not that well known. But Yiddish has a much higher degree of what linguists call component consciousness, of being able to know this kind of stuff than most languages do. But there are things that slip through unnoticed and are obviously not very important. So the way you say to say farewell in Yiddish, like, you know, they bade each other farewell, is almost like gesegen in Zip means, you know, to bid somebody goodbye or do a farewell, whatever. This verb still exists in German, Segenwisch, but in a much more limited capacity, which is kind of where the Yiddish originates. Again, those of you who have ever read Shakespeare or something will have run across the phrase, you know, he signed himself and departed. What does signed mean in this instance? It doesn't mean wrote their name. It means made the sign of the cross. Segenen, gesegenen is exactly the same word. Religious Christians, on meeting each other the same way you ask a Jew, how are you? He says, Baruch Hashem. You know, blessed be God. This is the Jewish way of not answering the question. You know, all this tells you is that the speaker is alive enough to be able to get these words out of their mouth. How are you? Baruch Hashem. I mean, already I have heard people say Baruch Hashem good or Baruch Hashem schwer. You know, thank God it's good or thank God things could be worse. Likewise, religious Christians on meeting each other or before eating, and some of them still do, will cross themselves. This is where you get the English verb to sign. It's to make the sign of the cross. People used to make a little cross, a little X. The Yiddish verb gesegnen is a completely colorless word. It's used all the time, you know, gesegnen sah mit dein Onkel Rui, you know, say goodbye to your Uncle Rudolf. I don't think it dawns on anybody that what they're literally saying is, go up, make the sign of the cross, and get out of here. It's totally lost that sense. I mean, much as it has in English, it's completely lost the Christian religious sense that it once had. You know, it's in there, and, you know, the Sachmer Rebbe will say Gesegen Sach, the Lubavitcher Rebbe will say it, even the Gerda Rebbe will say it. It doesn't matter. It's become so deeply embedded in the language that no one is aware of the, you know, of its origin. You know, if you want to tell somebody to sign their name colloquially in Yiddish, you tell them basically to put, you know, into like a pot, lay your daddy down. Because how do you sign something, you know, in the traditional way, it's Berl Ben Shmer. You know, last names in Yiddish mean absolutely nothing. Last names in Judaism generally are fairly recent and they change with incredible rapidity, especially during times of, you know, when there was a draft. Seriously, you want to go for 25 years in the Tsarist army? I mean, I've changed my name. You know, how my family's name got from Landau to Wetzelbaum, I have the vaguest idea, but I think there was an empty uniform somewhere in the hall. People just change their names all the time. The only way you identify yourself is you are somebody Ben somebody, or son of, or somebody Boss, daughter of somebody. Dealing with men, and this gets into a whole other thing of, you know, men and women signing contracts, you sign with what's called Gewissnummer. You sign with the name under which or by which you'd be called to the Torah. So to lay your daddy down, this is the Yiddish equivalent of, you know, to jump a little south of the 49th parallel, give me your John Hancock. This is exactly the same semantics here. I see we are basically running out of time. Are there any last minute questions before we go?
It's Drainer Nishkans. Somebody's asking, where does the phrase Drainer Nishkans fall?
A spodek is a high fur hat of the type, say, the question was about a phrase, Hakmanishka spodek. Don't knock me a spodek. A spodek is a high fur hat of the type favored by Polish Hasidim, especially Gerer Hasidim. If you've been to Israel, you see these guys wearing what look a little bit like what the guys are back in the palace wear. This is a spodek. I've never heard Hakmanishka spodek. I've heard Dreimanishka spodek. I think it means the same thing. Don't turn me around a high fur hat of my favorite by Polish Siddham. The idea is somebody is like turning the thing around you and you're getting dizzy. And there are tears coming out of your eyes. The idea is with boredom. If you are stultified, you are ready to scream. You are so bored that you're dizzy with it already. That is the basic idea. Any other questions? You want to get back? You would, wouldn't you? You, I don't know what. Yeah, this lady has asked a very interesting question. So you hear this curse is gay and bad. Zolstmir gay and bad. Go to hell, go into the ground. You also hear Zolstmir nicht gay and bad. You hear from, you know, you don't hear it now because you don't know any mothers who have children young enough to yell at like that anymore in Yiddish. This is the kind of curses, don't drop dead, is what you would hear like from your mother who is really mad at you, but doesn't want, like, God forbid, that what she says should actually come to pass. You have to understand the Yiddish world view. If I walk into this room and I say, what a lovely crowd tonight, in Yiddish, is this a complete sentence? No, what's missing? Kanena or exactly, no evil are. You have to keep them away. If I came in here and said, what a lovely crowd, without the Kanena Hoira, I'm sorry, but half of you would drop dead before the end. Just to teach me a lesson. The Yiddish worldview is that every Jew on earth is surrounded 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, by Shaden and Dibikim and Reches and Gremlins and Sprites and Imps and I don't know what else, who have nothing else to do. Their whole mission in creation is to ruin your good time. Again, despite what apologists for political Zionism or whatever will tell you, you do not break a glass at a wedding to commemorate the destruction of Jerusalem. If you look, if they would look in the Gemara instead of talking, if you look in Brochus, in the first and sixth, in the first tractate of the Talmud, they're talking two things on the same page, that Rav Ashe and Mar Bar Rav Lutfer were both at weddings, and they saw the rabbis there were getting too happy. So they broke expensive glass goblets. Glass in the ancient world was violently, violently expensive. And they broke expensive glass goblets so people wouldn't be too happy. It's not that they didn't think the rabbis should be happy, but if you get too happy, you're tempting fate. You're asking for all these things to come in and wreck your good time. You break the glass. If you look at the toys, you know, there are two main commentaries that everybody has to learn when you learn Talmud. Is Rashi, who lived in the 11th century, and that's the standard. Then the toys, that is the additional commentaries, which are written after Rashi. Anybody who ever learned yeshiva knows, like, the toys are the bane of yeshiva students because they were written for people who knew the whole Talmud by heart. They're extremely hard to understand. The Toysfus here in Brochus, though, is about the only clear one in Gantshas, the whole Gemara. It says, Mikan Mahadalish, which this has been seen. This is where we get the custom of breaking the glass away. And you go argue with the Toysfus. You can't do it. And this is clearly what it is. It's what is called an apotropaic custom, a protecting custom to keep these things away. It's the same thing, Zosmin Nishtahar is there, and it's like you ask somebody, and there are a million old jokes about this. You don't ask how old are you. You know, the Altus der Yid is not a complete sentence. Mm-hmm. Yes, the Altus der Yid is intimate function. How old are you? You should live to be 120. Because otherwise the demons could hear as well. He likes being this age so much. We'll keep him there forever. It's all this kind of stuff. You will notice Sidham wear coats, the button by Western male standards, the button girls wear, right over left, like this. This is because there's a thing in the Zohar, the classic of Kabbalah, it says you should contain the left, which is considered the sign of stern, the side of stern judgment, inside the right, which is considered mercy. So they do that. But you got to give the shaitan their due. Many Siddhas still wear pants with button flies. Siddhic flies button left over right. Just to make sure that everybody is. Okay, we actually, I have to go. These fine Bulgars are going to be rather angry who are appearing next in this room. Will be rather angry at me. But I'd like to thank you all for coming. And there will be a bunch of questions.